From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. This week, VH1 is presenting a series on the music of the 70s, including a reconsideration of disco. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with one of the musicians featured in this series, Nile Rodgers, co-founder of Chic, one of the most successful disco groups, with such hits as Le Freak, Dance, 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 and Good Times. Rodgers has also produced hits for Madonna, David Bowie, Diana Ross, and the B-52s. Also, Maureen Corrigan reviews Marilyn French's new novel, My Summer with George. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Clinton signs the minimum wage bill into law today. It will give 10 million Americans a boost in their take-home pay. The bill raises the minimum wage by 50 cents to $4.75 per hour starting October 1st. It'll jump again by 40 cents next September to $5.15 per hour. Republican congressional leaders had opposed the minimum wage bill, but then they secured $21 billion in tax breaks for small businesses to help them cope with wage increases. The security guard being investigated in the Olympic Park bombing has passed a lie detector test. Susanna Capelluto of Peach State Public Radio reports.
Richard Jewell apparently took the test on August 15th. A former FBI agent was hired by Jewell's lawyer to administer the test. He says there is no doubt Jewell is innocent. Jewell has been interviewed by the FBI in the July 27th Centennial Olympic Park bombing, which killed two people. Last week, Jewell's lawyer, Jack Martin, said that his client should not take an FBI polygraph because they couldn't give him a fair examination. Martin has asked the FBI to either arrest his client or apologize to him. For National Public Radio, I'm Susanna Capelluto in Atlanta.
The publisher of Consumer Reports is calling for a halt in sales of 1995 and 96 Isuzu Troopers and 96 Acura SLXs because they may roll over during quick turns. The group wants a recall of all vehicles sold. Consumer Reports is telling motorists not to buy the cars. The consumer group rated the two sport utility vehicles not acceptable earlier this month. It is the first time in 8 years the group has handed out such a label. A study of the United Nations is critical of the United States' attitude toward the world body. Linda Fasulo reports from New York.
In a new report, a bipartisan study group sponsored by the Council on Foreign Relations and chaired by financier George Soros concludes that the cash-strapped UN has served and could again serve America's national interests. But Washington, along with other major powers, must decide what the UN can and cannot achieve. At a news conference, Soros said the group is arguing that the U.S. is damaging its own interests by trying to exploit the UN in partisan political ways. Currently, Congress has refused to release more than $1.6 billion owed to the world body, and the Clinton administration is threatening to veto a bid by Secretary General Boutros-Ghali to serve another term as UN chief. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Fasulo in New York.
Federal Reserve policymakers are meeting in Washington today. Analysts expect them to leave short-term interest rates unchanged. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up nearly 6 points at 5,705. Trading is light. This is NPR News. Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat has written to Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak asking for help in preventing the construction of new Jewish settlements. NPR's Suni Khalid reports from Cairo.
Arafat warned Mubarak in a letter of an explosion between Palestinian landowners and the settlers that has come very close because of decisions by Israel's new government on Jewish settlements in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. The Palestinian leader asked Mubarak to mediate between himself and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to halt settlements and get the peace process back on track. This month, Netanyahu's government said it would end a 4-year moratorium on new settlements imposed by the previous government. There are an estimated 130,000 Israelis living in settlements, along with 2 million Palestinians in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Some Israeli officials want to see the number of Jewish settlers in the occupied territories doubled in the next few years. I'm Suni Khalid in Cairo.
The Green Party has unanimously selected consumer activist Ralph Nader for president. He was chosen last night at the party's convention in Los Angeles. Nader says the country needs a political alternative to the two mainstream parties. He blames the Republicans and the Democrats for corporate tax breaks and bailouts. He says, as president, he would fight against corporate welfare. Nader says he's not worried that his candidacy might draw liberal votes away from President Clinton. He says Mr. Clinton has moved too far to the right on several issues. A spokesman for singer Mel Torme says the entertainer is in guarded condition at an undisclosed California hospital. Torme had a stroke 11 days ago and still has a respirator tube in his throat. The spokesman says the 70-year-old singer remains in intensive care. The stroke left Torme's speech slurred. He has since developed pneumonia and suffered a partially collapsed lung. Torme's wife and five children remain at his side. He's communicating by writing notes. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This week, VH1 is presenting a five-part documentary series on the music of the 70s. Friday Night is a reconsideration of disco. One of the featured musicians is guitarist and record producer Nile Rodgers. He co-founded Chic, one of the most successful disco groups, with hits like Dance, 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 La Freak, and Good Times. Rodgers also produced Madonna's album, Like a Virgin, David Bowie's Let's Dance, Sister Sledge's We Are Family, Diana Ross's album, Diana, and he co-produced Mick Jagger's solo album, She's the Boss. Rodgers is now working on Quentin Tarantino's new film and new albums by Bob Dylan and Paula Abdul. The record we're listening to, La Freak, is the best-selling single ever released by Warner Brothers.
Have you heard about the new dance craze? Listen to us, I'm sure you'll be amazed. Big fun to be had by everyone. It's up to you, surely can be done. Young and old are doing it, I'm told. Just one try, and you too will be sold.
Nile Rodgers, welcome to Fresh Air.
Now, thanks, Terry.
Before we go any further, I want to ask you about La Freak. How did you come up with that refrain of La Freak and with the title of the band Chic, which is also mentioned in the song?
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, first thing, the song La Freak was actually subtitled Freak Out. Because that was the hook. Freak Out. Well, what happened was my partner, Bernard Edwards, and I, we went to Studio 54 one night. We were going to visit with Grace Jones, who wanted us to produce her album. Anyway, this was our first time going to Studio 54, so we were really excited. And plus, we wanted to meet Grace Jones and have the whole backstage thing go on. And we go to the back door, and we give our names, and the guy looks at the list and says he doesn't see our names on there. And so we said, well, maybe it's under the group Chic. And then he really doesn't see that. So he doesn't let us in. We go home, and I happen to live around the corner. Yeah, it wasn't so funny to us. But I lived around the corner at the time, and we were really dressed in our Sunday best. And we went around the corner, and we wrote a song not unlike our Freak Out, but... it was another four-letter expletive, and it was not freak. Definitely started with an F and ended with a K, and it wasn't out. It was off. And Bernard and I were playing it, and we were laughing. We were having a great time, even though we were pissed off. And Bernard looked at me in amazement, and he says, you know what, Niall? This sounds great. What are you telling me? I'm telling you, man, this sounds really great. And I said, you think that we can get away with a record that says, blank off? And he says, well, let's change it. So we went, freak off. And that didn't have that nice ring to it, but we kept singing it. And then finally he said, whoa, freak out. And then next thing you know, we got on a roll and wrote the rest of the song.
What a great story. I want to play another hit that Chic had that had the bass line that everybody wanted. And I'm thinking, of course, of Good Times. This is one of the most borrowed bass lines in recent music.
Yeah.
Let's hear it, and then you could tell us how you came up with this rhythm.
Sure.
That's Good Times, the band Chic. My guest Noel Rogers co-founded the band and was the guitarist. So how did you come up with this rhythm?
Well, the interesting thing about this song is that the day that I wrote Good Times, I was actually in the studio with our drummer, Tony Thompson, at the time, and the bass player from Queen, John Deacon. And we were sitting in there and we were hanging out. And John was in the studio and Tony and I were actually, John was in the control room, and Tony and I were in the studio just vamping on the groove. And Bernard Edwards, the bass player, was late. So, Tony and I are playing, and Bernard walks in, and he says to the engineer, he says, "Damn, what's that they're playing?" And the engineer says, "I don't know. That's just something Niall came up with this morning." And Bernard ran into the studio, and he started fooling around with the bass, and I was screaming to him over the volume to walk through it, and he came up with that classic bass line. And the reason why I mentioned John being there, because Queen did the song called Another One Bites the Dust. And everybody says, "Man, did they steal that bass line? Were you offended?" I said, "Hey, he was in the studio when we wrote it." I was flattered. The thing is, musicians have always borrowed from other musicians since the beginning of time. I wasn't pissed off or anything. I thought to myself, well, how could he not be effective? We thought it was real cool.
That's interesting. I had no idea he was actually there while it was being done. Now, of course, that line was also used, sampled, I believe, in Rapper's Delight, which was, I think, the first rap hit.
Yeah.
Featuring the Sugar Hill Gang. Well, let me play it first.
The hip, the hip, hip, hop, you don't stop. Rock it out, baby, bubba to the boogity bang, bang, the boogie to the boogity beat. Now, what you hear is not a test, I'm rapping to the beat. And me, the groove, and my friends are gonna try to move your feet. You see, I am Wonder Mike, and I'd like to say hello. Up to the black, to the white, the red, and the brown, and the purple, and yellow. But first, I gotta bang, bang, the boogie to the boogie, say up, jump the boogie to the bang, bang, boogie, let's rock. You don't stop, rock the rhythm, that'll make your body rock. Well,
so that's the Sugar Hill Gang using the bass and guitar line that you and Bernard Edwards came up with for your record Good Times. How did you first hear this, and what was your reaction when you did?
Now, this is funny. When I first heard Rapper's Delight, I was at a club in New York, a disco, if you will, called Leviticus. And the DJ was a good friend of mine, and he played this song. The thing is that in those days, DJs, at least the good ones, would rap over their favorite records. So I thought that he was doing that. I had no idea that he was actually playing a record. I thought he was in the booth with a couple of his buddies, and they were kicking this rhyme over the record. And then I noticed that it was not Bernard and myself playing. In fact, it was our riff, but it was not us playing. Well, I could tell right away that it wasn't us. But the thing is that this is something that's not known to a lot of people. Back in the old days, what we used to do is we would go into a little recording studio and we would record the groove of our favorite record, make tape loops and sell them to DJs, and they'd go around playing it at clubs. That's how we got our start as producers. We'd take our favorite songs, go into a recording studio, record the vamp, and put other stuff over it so we could have extended records of the things that we liked. In the dance days, in the disco days, as most people call it now, the longer a song went on, the happier the people were. So when we first heard Rapper's Delight, we thought that it was just a rhythm section that recorded our groove, and that the DJ who was there on the spot was rapping over the record. Then when he told us that he bought it in Harlem, I went, wow, let me get a copy. He gave me a copy, and I noticed an interesting thing when I got it home. I played the record, and I realized that they had sampled our string line. That they didn't sample the guitar and the bass line, they just played that. But what they did was they took our record, this is before sampling, they took our record and put it on a turntable, and whenever the strings go, ew, they took our record and spun it in sync and went, ew. And I said, whoa, that's copyright infringement. You can't do that. What the hell? I'm going to pay $40,000 for a string session, and you can just take my record and get away with it and go, wow. So that was the big controversy with that.
Did you sue?
Sure, we sued.
Did you win?
Of course we won. Of course. That you couldn't take a product and just... I mean, this was before sampling. You know, there were no devices to do this. They just had a DJ with turntables live in the studio, and they just figured, well, what the hell? We're not going to spend any money and get a whole big orchestra and simulate that. We'll just do it. We'll just take their record.
Well, did you like the record?
I love the record.
Uh-huh.
It was one of my favorite records. It's still one of my favorite records of all time. I thought it was very clever and inventive. And, I mean, you know, early rap records to me were unbelievable, like, you know, groups like Sequence and stuff like that, Sugar Hill Gang. They were the same as any other R&B records. They were bands that played a groove, and the rappers would rap over the grooves. It only became later on that it was based on samples and loops. And I think these records are great. I mean, politically, we live in different times. When I was a kid, you know, we'd learn music in school. I mean, that was free. You know, you could take art and music and whatever, and if you excelled and you wanted to stick with it, you could do that. Now I hear from kids that they don't get music as just part of the normal curriculum.
Nell Rogers is my guest, one of the co-founders of Chic, and he is also one of the interviewees on the VH1 series being broadcast this week on the music of the 70s. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Nile Rodgers, co-founder of the band Chic. And let's see, he also has produced a lot of other people. He produced hits for Madonna, David Bowie, Sister Sledge, Diana Ross, to name a few. How was Chic formed in the 70s?
Well, we had a number of different monikers before we came up with Chic. The last incarnation of this group before it actually officially became Chic, we were a rock band called The Boys. And we were doing really well, just gigging around New York. But we could never get a record deal because when they saw us and they realized that we were black, they were like, oh, whoa, we can't get with this. How can we sell this? This is obviously before Living Color. So we tried really hard. All the record companies loved our music, but when they saw us, it didn't work. We learned something quite interesting about marketing was like, wait a minute, if your music says one thing, but you don't look like you represent the music, don't send any pictures. So we realized that dance music was now starting to become fashionable. We noticed that Frank Sinatra and Dolly Parton and all these people were doing dance music, doing disco, and we thought, well, that just sounds like what we play all the time, but why don't we get into the fashion element? Why don't we try and make something really original? So we sat down and we came up with the concept for Chic. I was actually in London at the time, and I saw Brian Ferry, Roxy music, and I said, damn, I like this. I like this fashion-oriented rock music. To musicians like us, rock music and R&B music were exactly the same. There was no difference between Kiss and Earth, Wind & Fire. It was just the style that they chose to play. But to us, the musicianship was respected in exactly the same way. And the reason why I mentioned Kiss is because they were the most theatrical, exciting band that we had ever seen. We used to go to a place in New York City, which was a big discotheque in the beginning called Le Jardin de Paris, and it was like the happening spot. And Kiss used to play upstairs. And we used to go check them out. And we said, damn, I forget the name of this place, some ballroom. And when we first saw Kiss, I said, man, that is amazing. If we could bring that to black music, we would rule. So we looked at Kiss's name and we took everything about their name. We said, ah, they have two S's and one vowel, an I and a K. And we said, chic, oh, cool. We got two C's and an I and an H, H-I-J-K. Yeah, chic, Kiss, yes. We, you know, and we did everything we could.
You didn't paint your faces.
No, we didn't do that because in black music, that would not have worked. I mean, Kiss were white people and they painted their faces white. If we were black and painted our faces black, what are we going to be, the minstrel men, you know? That wouldn't fly. We knew where to draw the line. But we did get the platforms and we liked leather and studs. That was cool. But we didn't go that extreme because we knew that our audience would be primarily a black audience. We knew that radio was important.
Now, how did your music take into account what dancers wanted?
Well, the thing is that when we first came up with the concept, we wrote a song called Everybody Dance. It's the very first song that Bernard and I ever wrote together. And the one thing we noticed right away was that if we had to do a groove record, instead of making a record where other kids would have to go out and record the groove longer, we would just do it ourselves. So Everybody Dance was 10 and a half minutes long. And we knew that if people danced to it and they liked it, they'd want to keep dancing to it. So we took Everybody Dance down to a little a club in the village called the Night Owl, and it was 10 and a half minutes long. We gave it to the DJ. He played it once, and to our surprise, he played it 8 times. That means he played the song for almost 90 minutes, and no one left the dance floor. It became like a little anthem in the village. Everybody was walking around the streets going, Everybody Dance, doo-doo-doo-doo, and only one club had it, and this place became packed behind this song, so we knew we had something.
Why did the longer grooves work so effectively in clubs, do you think?
Because I think when people start dancing, it was almost like a primal ritual. It's like a mating dance. You know, you meet somebody and you want to stay on the floor with them as long as possible, right? I mean, sometimes, like I know when I would meet a girl at a disco, I'd be very nervous. So you could sort of break the ice, and then, you know, you get to, sort of show your feathers like a peacock. If you have some nice moves and stuff, and they say, oh, this guy is cool, then they get to check you out and without talking. And if you had a song that, like, just grew for 10 minutes, you knew that that person wouldn't leave you for at least 10 minutes. And I'm serious. It made a lot of sense to me. So we made our grooves as long as possible, as long as we could go until they got boring to us.
Why don't we hear the record? This is Everybody Dance by Chic. That's the band Chic, and my guest Nile Rodgers co-founded the band, was the band's guitarist, and has also produced records by many other performers. When you were doing dance music, was there a sense of how many beats per minute you should have?
It wasn't nearly as as rigid and clinical as it is now. Because, see, we never recorded anything with a metronome. We just, you know...
Were other dance bands using a metronome to actually time out the beats per minute?
Some were, but not a lot in the beginning. See, as I said, to us, it was R&B music that you could dance to.
Right.
So, boy, we never... You only use metronomes and clicks for doing television commercials.
Mm-hmm, right.
We never thought that a groove had to have a specific, you know, beat per minute. We only got into that after being DJs and hanging around DJs that they'd start to file the records as far as the beats per minute were concerned because they wanted to keep the people dancing. That's why that became important. It wasn't necessarily important to get the people on the dance floor, but you wanted to be able to file your records and say, well, this groove goes with that groove and this beat is like that. You don't want to slow it down too much. And believe it or not, that's how it became popular. It had nothing to do with saying, well, if this is 120 beats per minute, we know people are going to dance to it. There were a lot of records that were 110 beats per minute or 105 or even 90, and some that were like 130.
Did you end up going to a lot of clubs just to watch people dance and get a sense of what the dances were that they were doing and what grooves seemed to work the best?
Yeah, in the beginning, the dances were everything to us. The song Le Freak was about the dance that was current at the time, which was a dance called Le Freak. And we decided to make that dance ours by calling it Le Freak, and we were making it Chic's dance. And I remember once we were on American Bandstand, and Dick Clark said, you know that this is the biggest dance record of all time, and no one knows how to do it. And we looked at him and thought, well, you don't know how to do it, but where we come from, everybody knows how to do it. I mean, this was the dance at the time. And then, and then The Hustle became popular, and actually The Hustle was happening, I think, before The Freak. And,
I hated that record. What did you think of that record?
Which record?
The Hustle.
You mean, do The Hustle.
Exactly.
At the time, it was actually cool. At the time, it was cool. See, the thing is that, you know, I mean, instrumental records were really, really cool back in the dance days. And it was a sort of pop sort of, you know, soft thing. It wasn't like the hardcore Hustle records, but... you know, it was cool. We were gigging in the Catskills, and these women were coming up to us going, did you teach us how to do The Hustle? And we thought, well, I guess this is cool, you know.
Were you doing in the Catskills?
And then we were gigging. This is before Chic. I mean, we used to work, just as professional bands, you know, just working in different places. We were a serious bar mitzvah band.
what did you play at bar mitzvahs?
Do The Hustle. And of course, Taha, Dodi, and all that kind of stuff. But we did Do The Hustle and Hava Nagila. You know, we were bad.
Oh, I wish I were there.
It was good. I'm telling you, we turn out the bar mitzvah.
Nell Rogers is a guitarist and record producer. He co-founded the disco group Chic. He's featured in this week's VH1 series on the music of the 70s. Rogers will be back with us in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more with guitarist and producer Nile Rogers. He'll tell us about producing Madonna's hit album, Like a Virgin. And then older women and romance. Maureen Carrigan reviews a new novel by Marilyn French.
Will she ever be a star?
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of our interview with guitarist and record producer Nile Rodgers. He co-founded Chic, one of the most successful disco groups of the 70s. Rodgers is featured in this week's VH1 series on the music of the 70s. Friday night's edition is on the disco explosion. Rodgers also produced hits for Madonna, Sister Sledge, Diana Ross, and David Bowie. This is Chic's first hit, released in 1977, Dance, Dance, Dance. To reproduce your sound on stage, the sound that you got in the studio?
Totally. That was the great thing about music in those days, is that Chic was the actual band. And it's like saying, you know, could Queen reproduce their sound? Even though Freddie Mercury did like those humongous layered vocals, when you went to see a Queen show, it felt like the vibe of the band. Now, obviously, you can't do everything exactly the same, but I guarantee you that a Chic concert sounded like the record. I mean, we brought our own strings with us, our own horns. We just did a big concert series in Japan a few months ago. And unfortunately, my best friend and partner died there, Bernard Edwards. He did the last show.
I wasn't aware of that. I'm really sorry.
Oh, yeah. It was, it was actually the most amazing time of my life because... You know, we were playing our music and we were packing these stadiums and it was incredible. And it sounds, you know, matter of fact, I'll send you a copy of the tape. You'll see that it sounds exactly like the record, or, you know, as close. You know that it's Chic. It's no, you know, you don't say to yourself, I missed the strings. I missed the horns. You hear them very well.
You know, people think of dance music from the 70s as being very much a producer's medium.
Yes, it is. The good thing about dance music is that because it's long, usually, if you have a 10-minute song, it has to be very well produced. It's like if you have a long film or a long book, it's got to be well done, or else you're going to lose interest. So dance music really became a producer's art because you have to make the record interesting. It's like when you hear those Beatles records that are long, like A Day in the Life. The reason why it's so great is not only is it a great song, it's because of the immaculate production, because you're interested for all those minutes.
Can you talk a little bit about how you and your late partner, Bernard Edwards, the bass player, would work out the rhythms together and the interplay that you'd get between your guitar and his bass? And you used your guitar in a very rhythmic way.
Right. Well, you see, before we became Chic, we were a cover band. And we realized earlier on that... that we were a small unit. It was the only way that we could make any money. They weren't paying much. So we learned how to cover all the parts with just the bass and the guitar because we were the only people that we could depend on. You know, we usually have to pick up a drummer or pick up a keyboard player, and we didn't know how proficient they'd be. So Bernard and I would cover all of the what we would say would the main parts of a pop record, so that people, when they heard the song, when they heard us play the song, they'd hear all those familiar parts. That wound up becoming our style. So when we wrote our own songs, we decided to cover all of the important orchestration in both the bass and the guitar. So Bernard developed this very melodic, rhythmic way of playing bass, and the interplay would sort of make the whole statement of the song. Like usually when you sing a chic song, you'll sing like, you know, good times, doom, doom. These are the good, doom, doom, doom. You know, you hear the bass and the guitar while you're singing the hook. And
right, it almost becomes part of the melody. You can't sing it without it.
Bingo. And we go, freak out, little freak, say chic. Freak out, you know. I mean, that's how our songs are written. That's what we do. That's how we do it.
Right, right. Now, you've also produced a lot of hit records for other people, including Madonna, David Bowie, Sister Sledge, Diana Ross. I was listening back to Madonna's "Like a Virgin," which you produced, and it's a really good production. I was wondering, listening to it, whether you sped up her voice just a little bit.
Never.
Really?
Never,
it sounds just like slightly sped up to me.
No,
slightly
it's not.
Faster and higher, no?
Nope. As a matter of fact, I'll tell you exactly what. The way you can always figure that out is just check the key of the music. Just pick up an instrument and play, and you'll see it's not sped up. What happened was Madonna had these demos that were sent to her from all over the country, and she liked the songs, and she learned them in those keys. And the first thing I said to Madonna when we were working on them, I said, you know, Mo, I listened to your first album and you sound a little warmer and richer. You know, maybe we should go for that sound. And she says, no, I like these songs. In other words, she had learned them in those keys and she didn't want to change them. And I said, well, you know, it sounds a little like a mouse, like a little toy, like especially on like Material Girl. And she says, this is the way I want it. So that's what we did. And the thing that was great is that it forced her to increase her range. But it's funny you asked me that, because that's the same thing the record company did. They called me up and says, hey, Niall, what did you do to Madonna's voice? I says, hey, Niall, what did you do to Madonna? I got her to sing the damn song in the key that she wanted to record it in. I didn't do anything.
Well, why don't you choose either Like a Virgin or Material Girl and tell us about the production on it?
Now, here's the interesting one. Material Girl is the one that everybody questions the voice. Now, the thing is that this is the first time I ever played keyboards on a record. What happened was, actually, I don't remember what happened, but for some reason, the musicians got confused and weren't in the studio that day, and it was just Madonna and myself sitting there. And she said, well, now this seems like a part you can play. Why don't you just play it? And I said, well, okay, I'll take a shot at it. And I played it, and it was cool, and we liked it. And she said, it sounds like a record to me. It was, you know, I decided to put the men singing backgrounds on it because I wanted to have a real contrast between Madonna's voice. Little did I know there'd be that much contrast because she's singing a little out of her range. But I wanted to come up with that sort of, I wanted to have the guys to have that sort of monotonic, like Gregorian chant kind of vibe with that living in a material world. That's what I was thinking of. It would be sort of like, you know, when you go into a big Catholic church, and I knew that was Madonna's whole thing. So it was subliminal, but it was cool. It wound up working and she liked it.
This is Material Girl, Madonna, produced by my guest, Niall Rogers.
Yeah.
Rogers is my guest. He produced the track that we just heard. He's one of the people interviewed on the VH1 series about music of the 70s, which is running throughout this week. Now, Rogers, let me ask you a little bit about your own musical roots. I know there was a period when you were into protest music, Phil Oakes, Tom Paxton. How did you go from protest music to good time music, to party music?
Well, the thing is that when I was into protest music, I was in high school. And the Vietnam War was going on, and I was also in the Black Panthers. As a matter of fact, not only was I in the Black Panthers, but I was in, you know, YSA, Young Socialist Alliance, and Socialist Workers Party, the whole thing, the Peace and Freedom, you know, all that stuff. Whatever you know, whatever kids in New York did in those days, I seemed to be into it. And the thing is that I became a guitar player because I always had music in my blood, if you will. In school, I played orchestral instruments. I played woodwinds. I played clarinet and flute. But I realized that the guitar was cool because in a demonstration, you can carry your accompanying instrument with you. And I said, wow, this is cool. So I started playing folk music and protest music and started panhandling for money in the park, in Central Park, and in the village on 8th Street.
Wait, let me stop you. Did you pick up a lot of women that way?
I wouldn't say a lot. I was actually incredibly shy. When I was younger, I was the skinniest man in the world. Even in the beginning of Chic, I was 25 years old and my waist size was 25. It was incredible. Bernard used to say to me, man, I can't wait till you get 30 so you can have a 30-inch waist. But I was really skinny and I was not confident at all. But I did meet a couple of good girls, yeah. I wouldn't say a lot, but...
All right. So you were panhandling in Central Park when I interrupted you.
Yeah, and so music just became a part of my life. And I just sort of, you know, I changed with the times.
My guest is guitarist and record producer Nile Rogers. He co-founded the 70s disco band Chic. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with guitarist and record producer Nile Rogers. Now, there's a story I have to get you to tell. Apparently, you were, I think, a bodyguard for Jimi Hendrix when he was performing a prison concert. Do I have that straight?
That's almost correct. No, I was in the Black Panthers, and we were standing security on the stage for Hendrix at a Randall's Island concert. Hendrix performed. There was a festival, and I don't exactly have the name right, but it was the Randall's Island Music Festival or something like that, and this was after the Cream had broken up, and so it was a Tony Williams Lifetime with Jack Bruce, and it was very eclectic hip musical times, and Hendrix performed there, and the Black Panthers provided security, because Randall's Island, even though I don't know if it's officially considered Harlem, certainly is Harlem to Black people. I mean, that's where all the Puerto Rican baseball players play, you know, the softball teams and stuff, so it felt like Harlem. It was probably like about 120th Street in New York, just right across the bridge. So the Panthers provided security.
And if you were so scrawny and skinny, how convincing were you as one of the Panther security people?
Well, I was scrawny and skinny, but I was quite the martial artist. I used to teach, you know, Kung Fu and Karate to the Black Panthers, at least my section. I used to be... somewhat security at the Fillmore East in the village.
No, really.
Oh yeah. As a matter of fact, a guy who was a brown belt in my style of karate was the main guy who organized all the bouncers. And you know, in those days, I have to say that there weren't nearly as many physical incidents as there are now. People were really cool. Hippies were cool, and there were very few fights with hippies. It just was people were really peaceful. And they shared a lot. Everything was very tribal and very communal. Basically, out of all the times that I stood security, we would usher people off the stage very nicely, as a matter of fact.
How?
I never had to throw anyone off the stage. I would say, hey, come on, man, be cool. And they go, oh, sorry.
Oh, so how did you get from more political music to good time music?
Well, as I said, I was a kid. I was very young, so you change with the times. I mean, think of what you were doing when you were 14, 15, 16, and 17. I mean, you could go from one vibe to the next in a few months, and you felt like it was like a century ago. When disco became popular, it actually just sort of happened around us because we were playing R&B music were gigging. So we played R&B music primarily because we were black and those were the gigs we got. However, we were a well-rounded man. We had a strong rock set and, you know, like I said, we played bar mitzvahs and the whole nine. And that's all that happened is that music changed around us. We were young and impressionable and we went with the times. And in those days, you had to be very original. So what we did is when we saw how the whole fashion thing was working in music, we decided that, hey, we could pretend to be this. And that's what we did. We just we fashioned a group that was based partly on Cab Calloway, partly on Kiss, and partly on Roxy Music. And that's how we put Chic together. We wanted to have the vibe of you know, Duke Ellington, the sophisticatedness of those type of artists. We wanted to have the excitement and the dress-up factor of Kiss, and we wanted to have the slickness of Bryan Ferry with the girls around us and the whole model thing. We were into that. That seemed cool. That was a nice perk.
There were some incredibly silly records that came out during the disco period. I think my vote for silliest might be Saturday Night Fiedler, which was Arthur Fiedler in the Boston Pops, and he's on the cover in that Saturday Night Fever pose with his index finger in the air wearing the white suit. What's your vote for one of the silliest albums of the disco period?
It's pretty hard to top that one, but I really, really hated Disco Duck. Hated
yeah.
it. There were millions of them, and that used to piss me off because, you know, to Bernard and myself, the kind of music that we played was very sincere, very passionate, mm-hmm. and totally not like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it really made us upset because, you know, every now and then there would be a parody of like a rock record. Like, you know, you have somebody like Weird Al Yankovic, mm-hmm. but he's just one artist, you know, doing it. And it's funny. But when you have like a whole nation or a whole world of people sort of co-opting the music that you think is sincere and wonderful, and they do that to it, you say to yourself, oh, God, it's just a matter of time before we're history, you know. And
right.
And that's what we used to say all the time. Bernard would look at me and say, yep, are we black history yet? And I'd say, man, you know, they keep putting out records like this, we will be.
So when did you decide to give it up?
Give up Chic?
Yeah. Give up
that
kind of dance music?
Well, it sort of just happened around us. You know, unfortunately, we had all the problems that people had in the 70s. We weren't unique. You know, we had the drug problems and the alcohol problems and the press problems. We started reading press and believing that stuff. We started thinking like, wow, is that what we do? Man, yeah, we did sell more records than anybody. Yeah. And then we started fighting and then people really started to criticize our lyrics. The main record that brought us down was Good Times because everybody, the country was going through a sort of a recession at the time. And people were saying, how could we write songs about good times and happy days are here again and everybody's having all these financial problems? And we're going, well, because in clubs, no one cares about that stuff. You never go to a club and meet somebody and go like, damn, you see what the market did yesterday? Yeah, wow. No one is thinking about that stuff, you know? So we didn't, in other words, it wasn't that the music was, it wasn't that our music was apolitical. It's just that, that's not what it was supposed to be about. It's relief music, you know? It's to get away from your normal life. So anyway, we didn't do that. And boy, did we catch a lot of, it was not good. And then that was the beginning of the whole disco sucks movement. So we, as the geniuses we were, decided, well, we're going to change our way of doing music. And we did an album called Real People. And that was really the beginning of the end. Because we changed our whole musical style. We changed our lyrics, talking about how we wanted to live our lives with real people. Come on, we didn't care about that. I mean, we had real people in our lives. We never talked about politics in our music. When Bernard first met me and I was in the Panthers, we sort of had an agreement. He said, man, yo, brother, you're not going to bring that bullshit into our music. And I said, all right, man, now I hear you. So we had a gentleman's agreement that our music would be something that he and I shared together about our lives, and that he wouldn't bring his stuff into it. He wouldn't bring his, his stuff into it, and I wouldn't bring mine into it. We'd come together as Chic and create this thing that was all about Chic. And we changed. We did it to ourselves.
Well, Nile Rodgers, a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Nile Rodgers is a guitarist and record producer. He co-founded the disco group Chic. He's featured in this week's VH1 series on the music of the 70s. Friday night's program is on the disco explosion. Here's one of the hits Nile Rodgers produced, Sister Sledge's We Are Family. Coming up, older women and romance. Maureen Carrigan reviews Marilyn French's new novel. This is Fresh Air. Marilyn French has made her reputation as a popular novelist whose books, like The Women's Room and Her Mother's Daughter, focus on topical women's issues. In her latest novel, My Summer with George, French entertains the subject of older women and sexual desire. Book critic Maureen Carrigan has a review.
Books about the upbeat aspects of aging have become big business as more baby boomers are becoming members of AARP. Much of the "you're not getting older, you're just getting better" type literature directed towards heterosexual women has extolled cronehood as a liberated stage of life, one where a graying gal can finally let it all hang out because she no longer gives a hoot about attracting the opposite sex. But there's an alternative trend taking shape in the literature of female aging that disputes this chaste vision of empowerment. Last spring, Doris Lessing brought out a novel called Love Again, in which her 65-year-old heroine becomes entangled with not one, but three much younger men. And now Marilyn French has published My Summer with George, in which another 60-something woman falls in love. this time with a somewhat younger man in his 50s. None of these affairs work out or are even consummated. What Lessing and French both affirm, however, is the stubborn indomitability of lust. It's the dizzying and humiliating condition that was characterized by the poet W.B. Yeats when he was in his old age as having a heart sick with desire and fastened to a dying animal. At first, my summer with George masquerades as little more than a postmenopausal harlequin romance. After all, its heroine writes romances for a living under the outrageous pen name Hermione Beldame. At a party one afternoon, Hermione meets George Johnson, an intense stranger with turquoise eyes. Over the next few weeks, George calls Hermione for dates, yet he remains aloof. Meanwhile, Hermione is smitten, confessing at one point, "I was a walking throb." You don't have to be a romance reader to recognize this boilerplate plot. By novel's end, Hermione should discover either that George has some benign bodily deformity, like a third nipple, that's kept him from getting intimate, or that he's a villain who has a wife locked up in an attic, in which case she'll marry his best friend. The end. But devious Marilyn French has an altogether different story in mind. As the novel progresses, she shifts attention away from George, who remains Mr. Mixed Message, and instead flashes back to Hermione's youth to trace the positive and negative influences of romance myths over her life. We meet a scrappy teenage Hermione, child of the Depression, who works her way out of a bakery and into college, only to have her career dreams foreclosed by a moment's passion. Trapped in a sour marriage, Hermione reads romances for escape, and then begins writing them to help herself literally break free. Even though after three more marriages and many affairs, Hermione knows the traditional romance ideology she purveys is pap, she's still vulnerable to its power. In the grips of her obsession with George, she says, "I felt I was fighting for my life. Perhaps my brain knew I was fighting not for my life, but for the life of the dream, but so identical to my own life had it become that I knew I could not live unless the dream came true." My Summer with George is nowhere near as reflective as Lessing's Love Again on the topic of love in winter. But it's more fun to read, because as French is critiquing the romance fantasy, she's simultaneously weaving a career fantasy about a woman, Hermione, who writes herself out of a dead end and into a fairy tale life featuring summers on Long Island, nightly dinners at the best Manhattan restaurants, and scores of accomplished women friends. Hermione may not get her man, but she gets something even rarer. A spacious New York apartment with a Central Park view.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed My Summer with George by Marilyn French. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Alan Tu, and Amy Sallet, with Barbara Bogave and Louisa Shafia. Research assistance from Rena Bander. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Cherry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.